Hey everyone, welcome to the 370th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a lot of stuff to talk to you about today, starting with Amazon's Madam A and advertising. We're also going to be talking about connected tractors and what it means when a private company controls a device that might get stolen. The CDC is buying tracking data. Fitbit and Google's wearable service might come out sooner than you think, or as soon as we hoped. We've also got some product news from Wyze, Leviton, and Qualcomm. And we're also going to talk about Kevin's latest smart home purchase and his review of the Schlage HomeKit-enabled Encode lock. We're also going to hear from Bianca Wiley, who is a digital activist who is going to talk to us about how to build sustainable and accountable smart city infrastructure. And we're going to be using Canada's contact tracing app for COVID as an example of how to build and think about this. It's really an important interview. We're also going to be hearing from our sponsor Impinj. But before we get to all of this, let us hear from another one of our sponsors, Influx Data. At Influx Data, creator of the time series data platform InfluxDB, they believe in putting the developer first. They built their time series platform with tools so developers don't have to make wholesale changes to their products or applications just to use InfluxDB. Developers can code in their language of choice using their preferred tools and wherever they're building applications, in the cloud, on-premise, or locally. If you build IoT, analytics, and cloud applications, check out InfluxDB. It has a powerful API and toolset, a high-performance time series engine, and a community of developers in both cloud and open source. Get started for free and learn more at www.influxdata.com/stacy-iot. All right, first story. And I should also note, just for anybody who's surprised, because who knows what's going to happen on Wednesday, we're recording on Tuesday, so we're recording a little early this week because things are happening in Kevin's world.
Because it's all my fault. You can say it.
I did, but I did it nicely. I said, things are happening in your world.
You did.
And that's okay.
You're polite. You're polite. I'm a realist.
So if there's missing big news, blame Kevin, and we'll cover it next week. Don't worry. Or you can check it out in the newsletter, because that'll still be coming out Friday.
I did ask all the companies that we usually cover not to debut anything tomorrow.
So. We'll see if that works.
It's not going to happen.
Big story. It actually came out Friday, and good news. No, it's not good news. I was going to say this is good research. Let's go with good research. This is researchers from the University of Washington, UC Davis, UC Irvine, and Northeastern University looked at how Amazon's smart speaker uses data from your audio to advertise to you. And it's not just Amazon advertising to you. It's actually Amazon selling ads to people who sell on its platform. So there's a lot to unpack here, but I think this is really important research about privacy, maybe about consent. Let's talk about it, Kevin.
Yeah, we should be clear that Amazon has refuted the findings of this report, saying that they believe it's flawed.
Well, they've refuted some of the filings, and I think this is really important. There are two things to know here. One, Amazon is using targeted ads on the smart speakers based on what you ask for. So you might get Amazon pointing out, by the way, you could order this because this is on, you've put this on your shopping list, right? So that's one thing. And Amazon has confirmed that, yes, they do that. And they provide you with a way to opt out for it. But the people behind this report also say that Amazon takes your voice utterances and uses that information to create demographic profiles and sells that to companies that are trying to buy ads on the Amazon shopping site. And they're also, your third-party skills can collect your personal information, but we are aware of that already.
Right. So they don't have any real hard data, like tracking the actual information that's being collected and being sold, so to speak. What they did is they kind of created a test. But what they did is they created fake personas, basically with some demographics, like they put in some things about spirituality, connected car, smart home, pets, etc. And then they use the smart speakers as if they were that persona. And then they say that based on statistical analysis of the results, each persona was served targeted ads elsewhere on the web. So that's what led them to believe this is being done.
And Amazon says that that is not true.
Well, then how is it happening?
The researchers also say that only processed transcripts from the searches, not the actual voice utterances, so not the raw audio, is in there. And Amazon does say that they don't share the raw audio. They do share transcripts and create demographic profiles.
Yeah, that's not surprising. I mean, people who are buying data, they want the usable data, not in this case, raw audio is one thing, but it would have to be processed to determine what the usable data is, right? So that doesn't surprise me
at all. And that usable data is sent to interest profiles or demographic profiles. So if you're constantly asking about mom topics, or maybe if you're asking it to play Baby Shark a lot, then you're probably shunted into a mom demographic or a parent demographic. So that's an interesting example, actually, because they're actually using data from a child, if you think about who's probably asking Baby Shark to be played 8 million times. This is really interesting research. I'm going to try to talk to these folks, have them on the show to talk a little bit more about this, because I think it's so important. And I think it's really important to get this clear. Reading this, I was like, well, I know that Amazon is using the data I give to it to tell me, by the way, this is also on sale, or it'll tell me, like, it's seen that I've looked at something and that it's, you know, available now, or it'll tell me about a movie that's available to rent on Amazon Prime. And I hate that. I hate when Madam A tries to sell me anything. That's why Madam A 9 times out of 10 now lives in my storage closet. It's just too chatty. And I've actually turned off a lot of these things.
Yeah.
So that's clear. But this is kind of a violation, even if it's not your, or is it? Did you suspect that your data, not your actual request, but the information in your data was going to be used? And this says as many as 41 advertising partners.
Yeah. I mean, I think I assumed that Amazon would use the data that it collects from my audio requests to promote products on its own site to me. Yes. If indeed it is using that data and selling it to other advertisers to have promotions targeted to me on other sites, A, I wasn't aware of that. B, I didn't sign up for that. And C, I don't want that.
Got it. So this is basically, the authors are saying, at a minimum, we should see a lot better information shared about how smart speakers track and collect and sell data, and how the skills themselves do it. Because it's not just Amazon. Mm-hmm. It, you know, you could activate the, it's been so long since I've activated a skill that isn't like a smart home device. I'm like,
The Google Nest skill.
Exactly. You know, what data gets shared with them, and how then do they use those voice utterances data? I don't know.
The internet is a very transactional place now. It's a very, that's the type of experience it is, that nothing is for free anymore. I don't want to say it ever was, but it's less so now. And we don't even know all the details on how that data is maneuvered around and sold. So
here's another wrinkle in the life of a connected device.
This is good news, I think.
Is it?
I think so.
All right. So why don't you tell people what it is, and we'll talk about why it's good or bad.
Yeah. Obviously, everybody is well aware of the situation in Ukraine right now with Russia. And CNN reported that Russia basically took about $5 million worth of farm vehicles from an area in Ukraine. They sent it over to Chechnya. And guess what happened when it got there? It didn't work.
Nothing happened.
Nothing, exactly. They wasted all that time, effort, and gas for nothing, because all these were remotely disabled. Thank you, John Deere.
Yeah, this both talks to the Russian kleptocracy. How would you say it?
Okay, I'll go with
that. Yeah, their army basically stole all of this from a tractor dealer. It was a John Deere dealership. And we should note that John Deere is actually one of the big bads of the smart device movement in a lot of ways, because they lock down their physical hardware so much with software, and They're big proponents against the right to repair effort. If your tractor breaks down, you can't fix it yourself. You have to pay or work with John Deere to get it fixed. So most people are very upset over how John Deere treats its connected hardware. So with that context, the fact that John Deere was like, oh, you stole these things from us, from our dealer, rather. Here, we'll shut it down.
Most of the stuff is equipped with GPS as well, which is pretty typical for farm equipment that's smart because it's one way to track.
It's not just that. It's typical for farm equipment and precision agriculture equipment because they use GPS to get millimeter level or inch centimeter. I guess it's centimeter level accuracy in terms of planting and harvesting.
Very good accuracy.
Like, let me switch modes from nano and millimeters to, centimeters. So yeah, they know where they are. They know that they weren't purchased and boom, they just said no. So you think this is good. And I can see why you're like, haha, take it, Russians. I look at this and I'm a little concerned because once we have, like, this is John Deere operating over in Russia, but let's say that, and I'm trying to think of a company that isn't based in the U.S., but we'll use John Deere. And let's say the U.S. is at war with Canada, our brothers and sisters to the north. And suddenly the U.S. government starts pressuring John Deere to shut down the tractors up there or the equipment up there because they have that capability. And then these things become, basically the corporations become the arbiters of policy in some ways, and actually the executioners of policy. And then you can also just be like, well, instead of repossessing a tractor, maybe they just shut it down for a while and it's no longer useful if you can't quite make your bills. You know, there's lots to not like here.
Agreed. But I mean, in theory, I mean, certain vehicles, cars, for example, this could already be done. I mean, if your Tesla was stolen, I'm sure Tesla could find out where it is, obviously, but also deactivate.
I'm not worried about it in case of theft. I'm worried about it in case of, like, let's say the government is, let's say the police officers are chasing me. This is actually something that is being debated right now. I'm in a high-speed chase with the police. And maybe I just, you know, was scared and I didn't want to pull over right away. And then I got even more scared. Then what happens is, do they call? Do they brick my Tesla on the road? What does that mean for traffic implications? What does that mean without, like, having a warrant or a possible, you know, these are big issues.
They are big issues. Like, but my point is the technology and the power to do this is already there.
Oh, yes.
So you're being worried about it in certain contexts.
I just don't think it's a universal good. I think that these things, in this case, we're all like, yay. But in other cases, we're going to be like, and we probably need to figure out the rules associated with these and how to implement this capability.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. Speaking of GPS and tracking and tracing, what is happening with the CDC, Kevin?
I wish I knew. The CDC, or Center for Disease Control and Prevention here in the U.S., has apparently bought access to location data in the United States. And not just a few phones, but tens of millions of phones, according to Vice, which put out a report this week. And the point of this was for the CDC to analyze if people are complying with the COVID curfews, lockdowns, and so on. They specifically, and this is kind of bothersome to me, they specifically monitored the effectiveness of policy in the Navajo Nation. Why they targeted that particular group, I don't know, but I don't like it. But the bigger issue here is, like, why are they doing this? And people didn't know, obviously, because this is kind of like a bombshell report. But apparently, they paid $420,000 to 1 year of data.
Yeah, and that's cheap. I mean, they use this to track patterns for people visiting K-12 schools. They examining mobility patterns and the rise in COVID-19 cases. And in some ways, this gets into a debate. This data may be anonymized, but the argument is location data can never be anonymized because you always go home or to work. Each person has a very specific location pattern that could be discerned fairly easily.
Yep.
So that's one of the issues. So you're not actually getting anonymized data when you get location data. And then there's the issue of, they were looking to review how effective public policy was. Like, how were their rules? How are people following them? I don't think it was from a punitive perspective, but they were trying to track case loads, you know, based on policies they had set. So this was kind of like, hey, accountability. Let's be data driven.
Good intentions, I think. Yes, I would agree. But it just, what comes with that is the responsibility of what you're going to do with that data. Are you going to keep using that data? And are you going to use it for alternative purposes? Because once you have it, you can do anything with it.
Yeah, so there's that. There's also the fact that location data is incredibly easy to get in the United States. Your phone location is not just tracked by your phone individually, but also by other people. You can infer by the people around you where you are. And because it's never going to be anonymous, I think we have to look at location data kind of the same way that we look at PII, which is personally identifiable information. And the government has historically set rules for PII and defined it very narrowly. But I think it's time to add location data to that definition and probably some other forms of data, especially as we start looking at things like healthcare and algorithms that can finally detect things like heart rates and that sort of thing. We're probably going to be looking at, we should probably be classifying more data as PII and thus subject to higher strictures. Mm-hmm. That's my takeaway here, because I don't think it's reasonable to tell people to turn off location data on their phones because they lose so many other services. And this is why we have governments.
Well, I was just going to ask, does it make a difference to you that this is a government agency versus a corporation, or it doesn't matter to you?
The worry with government agencies is because government agencies have the power of the state behind them. So if the CDC wanted to say, hey, these people weren't enforcing curfew, that's technically breaking a law, we need to go find them and arrest them. Whereas a private corporation can't do something like that. So it is concerning that the government has access to this.
Right.
Again, I don't think that was the CDC's intent here, but it is something to be wary of when the government is collecting this type of data.
Yeah, and I would agree, because you can't effectively use the daily services that you use without dealing with a product from a company, right? It's like impossible at this point. So I would agree.
All right. Speaking of products from companies, hey, next week, it's going to be Google I.O.
Yes.
We are so excited here, not just because we like Google, but because I've been waiting for like Google's Fitbit plans for years. It's been years. Yeah, because the deal was announced. It took forever to close. And then Google's just been kind of futzing around and being like, yeah, we'll introduce something. So we talked about that because we saw last week, we talked about a like leaked hardware device that was left at a bar. And so we're like, ooh, this could be the watch for Pixel smartwatch. Yay. And now we're seeing that Fitbit and Google Fit Metrics are getting integrated into the Nest Hub, which is nice. I would like to see my Google Fit and Fitbit metrics just become one place personally, but that's just me as a Fitbit user. And well, I'm not really a Google Fit user. I have the display that tracks my sleep. And for that information, you have to be a Google Fit user. But yeah, I would like it to be in one place. Thank you. Please and thank you.
Well, it looks like it's going to be.
And that place will be on my Nest Hub. Yay!
You have to opt into it, though.
Yes.
It's not going to...
And be aware, like in my house, my Nest Hubs are all displays. So I'm like sitting here thinking, oh, now my husband can see how little I've moved. That could be bad. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, hoping for a big wearables push, wondering if we're going to see a services launch, like a wellness services launch, in addition to like Fitbit Premium, or maybe we're going to see more into Fitbit Premium from maybe some of the other Google services out there. I don't know, but I can't wait, Kevin.
I can tell.
Are you hot right now? Or maybe you're too cold.
I'm just right.
You're just right. I was like, Kevin is Goldilocks. But if you're me, your thermostat is not necessarily in the room you're in. And this is why Ecobee and Nest and a couple other companies have launched additional sensors for that work with your thermostat. And now Wyze has also done this. And their room sensor is going to be $24.99, which actually I feel is kind of expensive for a Wyze. But it doesn't just measure the temperature. It also measures
humidity, and it's also a motion occupancy sensor up to 17 feet.
Yes, and that'll work with, remember, Wyze has light bulbs, Wyze has security stuff, Wyze has lots of things. So all of this is now available to you for $24.99 if that's your jam.
Yeah, if you already have a Wyze thermostat, you can add That's for $25. You can get a 3-pack for $70. If you don't have a Wyze thermostat, they'll sell you one with the 3 sensors for $137.97.
Whee!
I will say this. I like this sensor because it's not just a sensor. I have an Ecobee sensor, mm-hmm. right? And it's just a little block. It doesn't show me anything. It doesn't do anything other than send data to the main thermostat.
Oh, you like this because it has the LCD screen.
Yes. I can't, it almost looks like e-ink to me, but you're probably right. It's probably LCD for cost purposes. And it shows the battery life of the sensor, if the room is occupied, the temperature, the humidity, et cetera. So it's nice to have something you can see as opposed to just a little block of plastic like I have.
Okay. See, I kind of like having just the block of plastic because you can kind of hide it away and you don't have to think about it. But I can also see the reason why you would be like, I would like it to show me the temperature in the room. So
yeah,
I can see both sides. Both sides. All right. Other new products. Leviton has launched a HomeKit-enabled Decora smart switch that it, and dimmer and bridge. And what's significant about it? It doesn't require
neutral.
Yes. No neutral.
No neutral.
So this means it's just that much easier to install, especially if you have a home that's older and does not have a neutral wire. You can still have a smart switch or a smart dimmer. Yay.
And we get a lot of questions about light switches for homes with no neutral wire. Oh, this is perfect.
Yes. GE also has one. And so Lutron had one for a long time. And that used to be the only option on the market. But now GE and this Leviton one exist. Yay.
You'd think that because it has less inside it, because it doesn't have a neutral wire inside it, it would cost less. But no, the switch is $45 and the dimmer is $50.
Yeah, that's just what a smart switch costs, apparently.
Exactly.
Other news, Qualcomm, they are debuting Wi-Fi 7 chips. I know. You might be like, wait, we just approved Wi-Fi 6. What? Huh? Ah! Okay, it's true. Wi-Fi 7 is not a ratified standard yet, but Qualcomm, MediaTek, Broadcom, they're all going ahead with their Wi-Fi 7 stuff. So it's going to be out there. Qualcomm's like, hey, if you use all the channels available to you, you could get up to 33 gigabits per second on your wireless network. Peak throughputs.
Who has a fast enough internet connection to actually use that?
Well, so this is interesting because I was talking with the people at Qualcomm and I was like, hey, are we at a stage or what use cases do we have today that require that sort of in-home connectivity?
What did they say?
We don't yet, but things like VR. Yeah, I know. They're building
things
like VR or maybe kind of point-to-point gaming inside the home. So you could have, instead of relying on your internet, you would have just data flowing from device to device in the home, which... if you think about something like having a set-top box or something like that, streaming content to a VR platform, that might make sense.
Yeah. Yes, it does. It makes sense. Listen, I'll never shy away from more wireless speeds. Never. However, for a 4K streaming video in the house, wireless, it's about 25 megabits per second. Mm-hmm. So like not even a hundredth of what they're saying they can offer.
Yeah.
Again, well, okay. I'm all for faster speeds, but...
well, here's the deal. To get that much capacity, you're going to have the widest channels possible. That's going to be only in the US because not all countries support all of those channels that these chips are going to make use of. And you're going to have to use Wi-Fi in the 6 gigahertz band. And... you're going to have both devices and routers that have enough power to support the RF that you're going to need, all of the antennas that you're going to need. So they're going to need to be larger devices that have sufficient power. So we're talking about things that are plugged in, things that are larger, that are going to be able to like have this capability. Your phones, your IoT devices, man, they're still going to be on Wi-Fi 5. I don't care what people are saying.
Well, they're starting with Wi-Fi 6 now. I mean, it's the transition is in place as of now.
Yeah.
But it's going to take a while just to make that transition. I mean, by a while, I mean probably 2-3 years.
Yeah. It feels too early for this. It feels like we're in danger of confusing the consumer markets.
We wouldn't want to do that.
Who am I? I'm just a random blogger / podcaster. So nobody listen to me. Don't worry. If you're upgrading your router, stick with Wi-Fi 6 or Wi-Fi 6E, because that'll future-proof you for a while. Don't even think about 7. Just don't.
Nope.
It's not there yet. And if you're on Wi-Fi 5 and you're not experiencing issues right now and you don't want to spend money on this, you don't have to.
Nope.
Okay. So that's that. Kevin.
Speaking of spending money.
Yes. What did you spend money on this week?
Actually, I made a modest purchase because I don't make a lot of purchases these days. Back in the old days, I would spend literally about $10,000 a year on new tech. These days, not so much.
I don't pay him enough.
When it has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with income. It has to do with what do I need and, you know, what do I get value out of? And lately, I have not been getting value out of my sink bulbs. Why? Because they are out of sync, ironically. These are the GE, the old C by GE bulbs that I...
Yeah, these are the old ones. And GE Lighting bought Savant and they have re-upped everything. These are the old Bluetooth bulbs.
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, they have worked really well for a while. But I think what's happened, we've had a couple of power outages. And that's when I started to notice they're just out of sync. The state of being on and off is not accurate, either in the app or in the room. Like we tell Google or we use the Google Home app to, or even the Senglet app to shut down all the lights and one will shut and one will stay on. And then when I flip the toggle switch, okay, it goes off, toggle switch goes to off, but then it goes back to on, even though the lights are out. And I'm like, no, you're all out of whack. And I've just gotten tired of it. Actually, I'm fine with it because I don't really sit in that room that these bulbs are in. My wife and daughter are fed up with it. So what did I buy?
What did you buy?
Yeah, you're going to be happy. I got a 4-pack of the 1100 lumen white ambiance Philips Hue bulbs for $80 on sale at Costco because they're having like a Philips Hue sale for the next couple weeks. So for $20 a bulb, I've got 2 bulbs to replace there. And then I've got 2 extra bulbs to use somewhere else later. I figured it was a good deal. So that's what I'm waiting on right now.
Nice. And you have a Hue hub, so yay.
Yep.
And just so y'all know, if you have a Costco membership, apparently these are on sale for the next couple of weeks. Yeah?
Yeah, they've got different discounts, 10, 15% on bunches of Hue stuff. And you don't have to go to the warehouse. I mean, I used to go there like on a weekly basis just for fun. I don't go anymore because you can't go walk in and walk out without spending less than $100. I just order them online.
That's like me and Target. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you also had a device this week to test. Tell us about it.
I really like it, but it won't surprise you when I tell you what it is. It is the new Schlage Encode Plus Wi-Fi Smart Lock. It works with HomeKit. It works with Google. It works with Amazon. I am using it with HomeKit, and the main big draw on this particular model is that it enables Apple's HomeKey support. So that means I can, actually, anyone in my family can use their Apple Watch or their iPhone to unlock the door using the NFC chip. So this is one of the first locks to have HomeKey. The lock doesn't look very different than the current Schlage Wi-Fi lock. It's got a nice numeric keypad, so you can always punch in your numbers to get in, which is what we generally do. Up till now, we've had very good luck with the Nest by Yale lock because of the number pad, because you can unlock it by voice. You can also use your phone, you know, with the app to unlock it. And this does all that as well. But again, that home key support is really the differentiator here. It took me all of less than 10 minutes to swap out the Nest by Yale and put in the Schlage. Very easy. I did have a hiccup setting it up, and I thought it was just a problem with the lock and the setup process. The problem turned out to be me. I had to go back and think about what I did. You actually have to have a Schlage account specifically for this particular lock in order to then use it with one of the voice assistants. So it wasn't the typical HomeKit setup, and I kind of went in circles for at least 20 minutes until I realized that. Once I realized that, and I got it, I was able to hook it up after I got my Schlage account going, and boom, they went into HomeKit just fine.
That's a little weird, though, because most HomeKit things you can just set up with just a HomeKit barcode kind of account.
It's only this lock, and I wonder if that's just a temporary thing or not, but the setup process explained it, and I just didn't really follow the instructions, but it explained it explicitly. So I'm not sure why that is, but once you're connected to whatever voice assistant or platform, you're good to go. I mean, it even says in HomeKit, would you like the Home app to get firmware updates for this lock? Sure. I don't have to use the Schlage app at all at this point. I could probably delete it, quite honestly, because I tend to use the Home app.
Yeah, they wanted your information, and by golly, they were going to get it.
It's just an email address and a couple other little things. It's no big deal. It works really well. And with the phone, it works really well. With a watch, you do have to double press the button on your phone or your watch to bring up the wallet cards, because that's where the key resides. It resides in the same wallet as your airline passes and your credit cards and so on that you use with Apple Pay. So there is still some interaction there. But I also found out there's an automation there, and I didn't have a HomeKit lock, so I didn't know this. This is probably not new for HomeKit people. It's new to me. There's an automation that will let me have the door unlock when somebody comes home. And I was thinking, oh, that's cool, but I don't know that I want it to automatically unlock when somebody's in the geographical area of the house, because maybe they get, I don't know, maybe they get attacked. And then because they're close to home, the door's unlocked and the person can get in the house. It doesn't happen automatically. It actually pops up a notification on your watch or your phone that says, do you want to run the automation to unlock your front door? And you tap yes. So I found that out going to get the mail the other day, and I came back across the street to the house and I was prompted. I'm like, oh, great. It doesn't automatically do it. I know it sounds less convenient, but from a security factor, I really like that. So
yeah, it's not hands-free, but it's more secure, which is like...
I'll go with more secure.
In a lock, that's probably the right call.
Yeah. I mean, if I wanted to, I could just raise my wrist and say, open the front door to the digital assistant, and that's essentially hands-free. So I can still do that, but...
It wouldn't ask you for a code for unlocking your door?
I have it set up in express mode, so it does not ask for a code or face ID verification or anything like that. So
if y'all want to rob Kevin's house, now we know how.
You just got to find me.
Okay, I'll get on that.
Anyway, so it's $299.99 for this lock. It's not the cheapest one out there by any means. But if you're HomeKit, for sure, that home key thing is just awesome. I love it.
Agreed. Okay, not that I'm HomeKit. Okay, now it is time for the segment of the show where we answer questions from you, our audience. That's right. It's time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline. And it is the end of the month. Actually, it's the beginning of a new month. So we have our April winners. And this lucky winner gets a Nest doorbell. And Kevin, who is our lucky winner?
That would be Jeff.
Jeff, we will reach out to you and let you know. And thank you for, actually, you sent us an email. You didn't call us, but it was a really good email. So we used it. Okay. If you would like to be entered to win, give us a call at 512-623-7424. And we might just answer your question on the air. And you'll be entered to win. And for May, because May, actually this weekend is Mother's Day weekend, everybody, call your moms, write a card, do whatever. I am going to give away my mom's favorite device that I've ever given her.
Wait, you gave it to her and you're going to give it away?
Well, not hers. Mom, I need that present back. I would never do that to her. It's the Ember coffee mug. And this is you really don't have to connect it to the app, but my mom, who hates all connected things, actually loves this and connected to the app because she finds it fun. It's a coffee mug that will keep your coffee warm, literally. That's what it does.
Or your tea.
Or your hot toddies. Soup. Yeah. Whatever you want to stick in there. So you can keep it for yourself or you can give it to your mom. Whichever. So if you want to win, 512-623-7424, and you will be entered to win. Let's hear from this week's caller, who's Keith from North Carolina with a question about Madam A. Let's hear it.
Yes. Hi, Stacey and Kevin. This is Keith Allred calling from North Carolina. I am hard of hearing, and there are a lot of beeps and chimes and microwaves and dishwashers and all kind of stuff throughout the house that makes a pitch of noise that I cannot hear. And so I was wondering, since Alexa can determine if your CO2 is going off or if your fire alarm is going off, is there any way to train any of the smart home products to where if a sound goes off that you can train it to that sound so that it will notify you like it will for if the fire alarm goes off. I do have interconnected Nest fire alarms that work really well, but I'm looking for a product that can learn a certain beep and notify my phone that something has completed or is going off. Thank you so much. I really enjoy the show and have for years, and I hope you guys continue. Take care. Bye-bye.
This was an exciting announcement because who doesn't want custom sound notifications? And you have a great use case. Unfortunately, I have to tell you that I thought we would have already gotten this, and we haven't. And actually, at the beginning of April, Amazon and Ford and said that Ford and Lincoln car owners would actually be able to train their cars to do custom routine or custom actions based on custom voice commands, based on AI learning for like the speaker. So I could say, Madam A, it's getting hot in here. And it would turn on the AC in the car, for example. And that was all kind of fun and exciting. Unfortunately, we don't have any sort of custom sound detection yet for consumers. And we reached out to Amazon, and their spokesperson basically said, the team is working to bring custom sound detection to customers as soon as possible. We'll share more details once it launches. Yeah.
Yeah, because they actually announced that they were bringing custom sound detection, so you could do what Keith wants to do. They announced that back in September, so just 6 months ago. It hasn't happened yet.
Nope. We'll keep our eyes and ears open. And hopefully, Keith, I mean, I would expect for them to release something. Actually, they may wait all the way until September. Like say, hey, that feature we launched last year, now it's available for you. That would be the worst case scenario, though.
I think you're going to see a lot of companies start bringing this type of train the AI to hear different sounds and do different things over the next 6 to 9 months, quite honestly.
Yeah, the chips are there. We've been talking about the chips. We actually talked about ARM's new chips. They built one just for custom-based wake words, right? Mm-hmm. So we're definitely seeing this stuff happen on the machine learning front and on the silicon that supports it front. So we just now have to see it get productized. Okay. Well, if you would like for us to answer your questions, give us a call, 512-623-7424. And that concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Bianca Wiley, who is a digital activist talking about how we need to think about building digital infrastructure for our cities. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Impinj. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Impinj, and I have Gaylene Meyer here with me from Impinj to talk about using RFID in the manufacturing and supply chain. So Gaylene, why don't you tell me about Impinj and how manufacturers are using RAIN RFID?
Some people define the Internet of Things as a network of powered electronic devices. Impinj expands the Internet of Things to include literally everything. And in the manufacturing industry, I'm talking about the parts that move along an assembly line, the tools and equipment needed for a job, or customized components delivered in by suppliers. The Impinj platform lays a foundation for developing IoT solutions that connect physical items to the cloud. Using RAIN RFID, the Impinj platform delivers the identity, location, and authenticity about everything a business needs to manage. RAIN RFID is a global standard that provides a unique identifier for any item. It can identify up to 1,000 items simultaneously without direct line of sight. And the low cost of tags make it the right technology for IoT applications tracking a vast number of things, like all the parts in a manufacturing plant. Impinj invents and builds RAIN RFID products, like the tiny chips that power a RAIN RFID tag, the readers that wirelessly identify tagged items, and software like algorithms and APIs that are used to build and operate RAIN RFID solutions. Manufacturing and automotive plants depend on RAIN RFID for automation, efficient assembly, safety compliance, and quality operations. With RAIN RFID, they can minimize or eliminate manual or paper-based processes that can be time-intensive and error-prone.
So we have heard about the use of IoT systems in car manufacturing. Can you tell us a little bit more about the role RAIN RFID is playing there?
Sure. IoT has changed the way machines and humans work. And IoT solutions, built with Impinj technology, include all the things stocked, assembled, and moved through a manufacturing plant for just-in-time operations. I'll give you some examples. Daimler AG has announced plans to fully digitize production operations by 2025, and their use of RAIN RFID is part of that program. For their Mercedes-Benz Sprinter vans, they automatically track and identify parts so production, logistics, and QA teams can know exactly where a particular component is at any given time. Volvo has also been using RAIN RFID since 2008 to track the car chassis throughout the assembly line from welding and paint shop to final assembly. Audi and other Volkswagen Group brands have a similar approach to using RAIN RFID for vehicle identification in the assembly line in the body shop. By providing key vehicle information such as the body design, paintwork, motorization, and equipment of a car, every vehicle that rolls off the production line is consistent with the configuration selected by its new owner. And talking about scale, Audi uses drones equipped with RAIN RFID readers to fly over vast parking lots of vehicles to collect data for delivery.
Where can our listeners go to learn more about Impinj?
You can visit our website at www.impinj.com. That's I-M-P-I-N-J. And take a look at our blog. We work with a global ecosystem of partners who innovate and deploy complete solutions used across a range of industries.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Bianca Wiley, who is a co-founder at Digital Public, which is a public interest firm based on digital governance. And we'll unpack what that means. But first off, you have done so much work on digital governance. We first talked, I believe, related to smart cities and the Alphabet's sidewalk efforts in Toronto. And I love talking to you and reading about what you're doing because you're thinking about how we can apply technology for the public good. So with that in mind, I wanted to talk to you about the COVID-19 exposure apps. And you have a very strong opinion. Would you like to share that?
Certainly. Well, the apps, which I'm in Canada, I'm joining you from Toronto, and the apps that we had for COVID launched in July 2020. And my opinion is that they need to be shut down because they're broken and they were not effective. And they continue to exist despite these things.
And we'll get into that. But I also think there is a secondary issue that actually for me might be the primary issue, which is the governments actually, when they launched these, they said that they would be sunsetted. And there's kind of an ongoing maintenance issue. Do you want to talk about that for a bit?
When the governments launched these apps, they said they would shut them down at some point. But what was never established was what the trigger would be for that shutdown. That is an important point to sort of pull out and say, for any kind of a public app or public health infrastructure or general public digital infrastructure, we need to have policy in place before it's launched or before things like this are started, because otherwise you just don't have that accountability mechanism to go back to. I mean, what we've got in Canada is it would be shut down. Okay, probably could have been shut down a long time ago, but I'm still trying to figure out who exactly would be pulling the plug.
Okay, yeah, and we'll dig into that. But in here in the US, we also have similar programs. I know that I downloaded the Washington State app and did receive one or two exposure notifications over it. But I remember back in the beginning when these were launching, we were all very concerned about using the Bluetooth tracking to track people as they go around their day. And people were like, I'm comfortable helping with public health, but I'm not really comfortable with keeping it forever. So I think there is an important accountability side to this, which is like, hey, we're only using it for public health. Are you worried that the tendency here is to overreach?
Well, I think, and this builds on your earlier point of wanting to use technology for the public good. What I think happens here is, and what I'm concerned about, is not having efficacy conversations. So I know that what a lot of people are comfortable talking about, or maybe think about right away when you hear this kind of an app and how it works, is privacy. And that's valid. And there was a lot of work put into the performance and the explanation of privacy. But when that takes over the conversation, what nobody seems to be asking is, does this even work? So if something's privacy preserving, but it doesn't work, I think that should stop it before it goes. And so we're kind of at this point where if the privacy requirement is met, that's all that matters. And that's a very bad situation to be in for the future, because what we need is stuff that works. Privacy is a consideration for sure, but we need to make sure that we've got efficacy.
That's true. So your number one reason for why this should be shut down is that it doesn't work. So can you talk to us about why you don't think these are working?
Yeah. So before this app and many launched, I mean, before the pandemic, it was known that you would need a very high percentage of people to uptake use of the app, right? So that was sort of what didn't work round one, is that you needed, and I'm not sure the exact percentage, but we're talking like a high percentage of people would have needed to have this app uploaded in order for it to work. That bar didn't get met. Okay. And that was expected, because no matter how much outreach or public communications you do, this is not something that anyone, I think, should expect you get mass uptake. So that's one issue. But the one that became apparent to me is that the core function of the app in Canada broke because our apps required that you had a PCR test. And what happened earlier this year was that capacity for PCR testing in the public labs wasn't there. And so you couldn't upload, if you had a positive diagnosis, you couldn't upload it to the app because you couldn't get the testing. And I think that's an interesting kind of brokenness, because the problem sits in the workflow of this app. That sits with public health and lab capacity. That's not like a technical break. That's a quality of and level of service provision from a testing capacity problem. So that kind of brokenness is not minor. I mean, that's the whole reason for this app, is to say if someone gets a positive diagnosis, they can upload those results and then notify the others who also have this app, right? So that was what set this off for me this year, was realizing people can't even, like, the app is really broken. Now, the only other thing I want to say about this is that from a science perspective and a transmission perspective, these things have evolved. I mean, the idea that these were designed before there was more understanding of the transmission of the airborne nature, before people were vaccinated, it just really throws the whole equation way off, what it was when the app was launched. And I think there's also conversations, I can't have them in any level of detail, but I know that there were weaknesses and concerns about Bluetooth and its efficacy from the launch as well. So we really have a pretty big pack of problems that should have been apparent before this was launched, at least enough so to have had a plan for them.
This is a public health app that is actually managed by, is it a government service that manages it, or is it a government appointed council that oversees it?
Yeah. So Health Canada is the business owner of the app. So they have the accountability for this app. So when I said earlier, you know, who's going to pull the plug? It would be Health Canada should be pulling the plug. However, when the app was launched, there was also an advisory council that was set up to provide public oversight. And part of their remit was supposed to be to talk about sunsetting the app. We've also got a federal and a set of privacy commissioners at the provincial level who made the same recommendation upon launch. If this is not effective, it should be shut down. So we effectively have at least two. We've got more than two. We've got the privacy commissioners and we've got this advisory council. Both of these were supposed to be holding Health Canada accountable to shut the app down. Neither of them have done it. And the advisory council has disappeared. It doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, okay. So we've got brokenness on a bunch of different levels. We've got the app being broken. We've got the oversight of the app. It feels like it has been kind of left out there to linger. When the app was developed and put out there, they talked about sunsetting it. Did they have any real rules around, like, at what threshold it makes sense to start sunsetting it?
No, and that's exactly what was missing. I mean, that was so apparently a problem when it was launched, and the privacy conversation just overtook those concerns. And there's another pack of stakeholders that are worth mentioning here that are from the tech industry. Google and Apple set up this protocol, this exposure notification protocol. And that was the protocol that was used in the design of this app and others. There's other countries who use this protocol. And part of what's important to raise about that is that you had Google and Apple setting the parameters for data collection in a public health crisis. And there was some friction there because I think governments might not have designed it the same way that Google and Apple did. But what they did was they sort of weaponized privacy to say, you can trust us and we'll design this so it's privacy preserving. And they told the countries that they could only have one instance of this app going because that would help increase uptake. So I want to call out, firstly, we've got Google and Apple inserting themselves. And there's an intermediary thing happening here where because of the App Store, because they're the ones that create the tie to, you know, between the phones and the government, they hold power. And then what happened in Canada, there's a firm called Shopify. They're in Ottawa. They do a significant amount of business. They're like one of the largest Canadian tech companies. Their volunteers are the ones that wrote something called COVID Shield. So they volunteered and wrote the app and then gave it over to the federal government to steward. So we've got multiple players from the technology industry that really are the source of where this idea came from. And I think that's important to note as well, because we're talking about the governmental accountability, but then we've also got actors with different incentives that influence the reason for this app to even exist.
That is a good point. Let's say this just lingers out there forever. Why is that so bad?
This is bad for the future of public technology. It's bad because it's not working. And to be someone who is trusted as a steward of technology, if the government wants to be, you know, a known entity for, producing, providing, and supporting technology, they can't have this history of implementations that look like this COVID alert app. So I think that loss of trust in what it means for the government to do technology well, that's significant. And I understand it's hard for governments when they've done a high profile launch to walk it back and say, okay, you know what? This is what we learned. It's not working. Now we're going to do the right thing and shut it down and walk people through it. That's what they should do, I believe, in order for them to be trusted in future. The way this is going now is it's broken and they're just kind of hoping it'll fade away. When that comes to roost is the next time they want to do something, right?
All right. So then the obvious question for me, because I'm an IoT optimist, I actually believe there's roles for this sort of technology intervention in our cities. You know, I think about things like sensors and roadways for detecting accidents. I think about being able to monitor your water quality or sewer overflows. Like all of those things feel really important to me. There's the potential for good. So if I believe that, what can we learn from this COVID app, or what should we take away from this for government tech deployments?
So the number one thing we should learn is that we need good policy to be created that will not only help us know when we would shut something down, but also to know when we would adapt it or when maintenance is required. I mean, how do we manage this asset through its full life cycle, which may include shutting it down, or it may include adapting it or evolving it significantly? I think that that road of what do we do if it needs to change is really important, because I struggle with that one. Like, I know some people have said to me, to use this COVID app as an example, they said, well, why can't people just upload their rapid tests? Or what if we turn it into something to just share public health information? Or, you know, like long COVID is a thing. I could imagine people saying, well, what if we turn it into something to track symptoms? And I think on one hand, it's good to be open to something evolving. But on the other hand, I think that's dangerous, because if something doesn't have to serve one purpose, there will always be people who will always find that next thing we could do with it, right? And so I think in order to get the best use of something, we need to think about that life cycle. And then we probably need to have a pretty difficult conversation where people will have a range of views about whether it's okay to evolve and adapt, or if you should really shut something down if its primary purpose isn't working. If we have to think what the one main thing is, it's that we need to design the policy that will manage the life cycle of any app or of any digital public infrastructure before it is launched.
Got it. And lifecycle management, it's the like most boring, excruciating part of software development. And maintenance of physical hardware is like the most excruciating part of like IoT development. So unfortunately, it's like, oh, you're picking the hardest thing. So you've talked about a lifecycle management plan. It also feels like maybe the scope of the project should be well-defined at the beginning, and maybe to have things along the way to make sure it's still performing as designed. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. And then what about this idea of responsibility, like assigning responsibility? Because in the public service, what happens is people come up with great ideas while they're in office, and then some poor city manager like implements it. And then the politician goes away, moves on, runs for president. I don't know. And maybe the city manager goes to another place. And then you've got this like orphaned tech infrastructure lying around.
The incentives to think about maintenance are low. Right? They just are. Like the incentives for a lot of governments is to launch something. When I really look at the COVID app, I think of it as technology as public relations. And that makes me concerned about climate. It makes me, you know, concerned about any major city issue where, or governmental issue, where launching the thing can make it look like you're doing something about it, but not actually have to have the follow through. Right? Because you can use the words, you can talk about climate. I think climate is a great example, right? Nothing more urgent. Absolutely devastating consequences right now of our failure to manage the climate crisis. And there's a lot of clean tech coming. Some of it is good. Some of it, it's unclear around its efficacy. But what there is a lot of demand to look like you're working on this issue, right? And so I think we just want to start with the cultural, political, social incentives, which are really biased toward the launch. There is no such thing for that for maintenance. Maintenance is just not the thing you want to talk about, not the place you want to allocate budget dollars, not the place you want to allocate a lot of attention. So I understand all of that, you know, and I hope we can see that there's nothing surprising really about that. But the reason I think this stuff has escaped public scrutiny is because you can't see it. And Stacey, I think this is so much, you know, around so much of the work that you've been doing to try to make this stuff visible, because like in terms of infrastructure and software, you know, if you can't, the hardware helps you understand that there's software and there's a lot more going on. And I've always thought that if people could see the state of our legacy infrastructure the same way they would see like a crumbling bridge, there would be public pressure to resolve it. There is no such pressure because no one can see it. And that makes it even harder to prioritize money toward resolving the problem. Because if no one can see the problem until you really have a big problem, like a major failure, why would you make it a priority, right? Like it's not as though governments don't have other clear, urgent priorities. You know, I guess I want to start there because we're already in a bad incentive structure to pay attention to maintenance.
That's true. And as someone who lives in a place with lots of crumbling bridges, I would say even when things are seen, lately we have a hard time spending money on them. We could go into a critique of short-term thinking and capitalism, but we're not going to do that. This is not the show for that. But before we go, I would love for you to tell me, as somebody who writes letters to the editor or visits with city council, what should I be doing or what should citizens be doing in asking their governments to do as they adopt these technology programs?
So what we should be doing from the public side, I think, to increase accountability for these investments and to make sure that they are properly maintained and that we design the policy, it requires that we change, I think, the frame a little bit of how we hold governments accountable. You, me, lots of people, I think we've seen the idea that you go to the government and you tell them you should do this. What I think is sort of helpful, and especially with technology, is coming at governments and saying, what are you doing about this? Because sometimes there is no there yet. With this app, with the COVID alert app, what I've been reviewing so far, I haven't found any policy. This was allowed to launch, even though people talked about effectiveness, without a policy. And so I think we need to bring the pressure forward just to say, okay, if you want to, you know, if we all want to get involved in this area of developing public interest technology, we need to all come together to say, how are we going to hold the governments accountable for it? What are our commitments to participate in that? And how do we help sort of set those parameters? And what that's going to require is that sometimes the answer before a launch is that you don't launch, right? And I think like that's where with so many issues in democracy, We need to engage with government earlier than we do. And so I think that's some of the longer work we have to do, is just thinking about how do we use older accountability mechanisms. We've got people who are ombuds people. We've got people who do audits. We've got people who are supposed to be watching the government, you know, even within the government. And so I think rather than what happens a lot with technology is you keep doing new. And I think what we need to ask ourselves is, what are our pre-existing accountability mechanisms that we use for things, unfortunately, to your example, for the crumbling bridge or the professionals involved in the creation of these things where they have duties and obligations to the public? You can't just make stuff and just, you know, okay, well, it doesn't matter if it works or not. If we don't all come together to do this, we're going to lose the potential upside. Because it's clear that this muscle hasn't been developed yet. This is still early, and it's going to take some time yet to get that sorted. But I think that's kind of the general direction. What are the policies? How do we do the maintenance? How do we make decisions about them, about any technologies? And also, other suggestion, that we have more shared governance of them, that we bring more of the public into the tables where we can sit around, much like, you know, standards bodies, where we get together and we participate in the governance. So that it's not all one-sided, so that the public has sort of a persistent voice in the matter. And I think a good place to end here is, like, democracy and anything related to governance, it's a constant process. It's never finished. You don't set it and forget it. You have to engage with it.
Oh, that is depressing, but also probably the right thing to do.
The third piece, I think, for future, which is really going to help in a sort of stewardship and co-design model, is to think about, what does it mean to be like a civic product manager? What does it mean for the requirements for our public technologies to come from the public? Because I think what we've seen is so much commercial framing around a lot of these technologies. And I think what we need to do is shift the market so that cities and governments say to companies and they say to the industry, hey, this is how we've all said we'd like this to work. What do you have? And that capacity really needs to be built within the public service so that all the people who work on the roads and work, you know, on the rivers and working in water, everything, that they become the requirements writers. So I think that's another area where we can work together, both the public and the public service, to shape and shift the market. And I think that's going to get us to some really good outcomes as well.
I like it. All right, Bianca, thank you so much for coming on the show this week.
Thank you for having me, Stacey.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.